And I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us on The Record. Now, let's take a moment to remember the summer of 2015 and the sight of dozens of kayaks bobbing in Elliott Bay in the shadow of a large offshore drilling rig. That was a protest against the oil industry over fossil fuels and the country's energy future. You might remember the term kayaktivists. Well, in a major move by President Obama yesterday, that could mean that that rig and those kayaks may not meet again off Seattle's waterfront. The president declared more than 100 million acres off the Atlantic coast and in the U.S. Arctic off limits to oil and gas exploration. And Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau also announced a similar move for the Canadian Arctic. For more on this, I talked with Bloomberg's Jennifer DeLoey. She told me what President Obama moved to protect.
Well, he basically took a huge swath of the U.S. Arctic waters and a portion of the U.S. Atlantic Ocean off limits. He made it off limits to future oil and gas leasing. So he basically said, indefinitely going forward, these territories cannot be sold to oil and gas companies for drilling, for exploration and production.
Why did he choose those areas in particular?
Well, with the Arctic, this obviously is viewed by environmentalists and others as, you know, extreme oil. It is oil that is tough to produce. There is not a lot of infrastructure even to develop it. And of course, this is a fragile ecosystem that would be challenged if there were an oil spill. I think, you know, obviously that is a familiar concern to residents of Seattle who, you know, took to Puget Sound to make their concerns about Arctic drilling known. So that kind of opposition, the environmental scrutiny, wasn't lost on the administration. So that's really why the Arctic was a target of the administration. With regard to the Atlantic, Obama was really targeting natural resources and canyons, underground, underwater canyons, 31 of them, that are really ecologically rich areas. They've been the subject of a lot of scientific study and really discoveries over the last few decades. So they're considered a special place, these 31 canyons, and he was able to take off about 3.8 million acres of them, removing them from future oil and gas leasing.
Well, President Obama's ability to do this involved him invoking a 60-year-old law. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, it's fascinating. So this is the law that underpins all offshore oil and gas development. But buried in this 1953 law, there is a provision, a 24-word provision that basically empowers presidents to, from time to time, withdraw from disposition any of the unleased lands of the Outer Continental Shelf. So in the past, this has generally been used permanently in very discreet ways, you know, to protect coral reefs and very special areas. It's been used by some presidents on a temporary basis to wall off, you know, many millions of acres. But it's usually been used discreetly. In this case, of course, Obama was listening essentially to environmentalists who have been for months laying the groundwork and lobbying the White House to use this in a big, bold way to say that this oil in the Arctic is just untouchable from a climate perspective, not to mention these ecological concerns, to say, you know, this oil should be off limits going forward.
You mentioned earlier, Jennifer, the kayaktivists that we saw here in Seattle. There were people who got in kayaks, they went out on Puget Sound, and they tried to stop Shell's ships from leaving the Puget Sound region to go up to the Arctic area. I mean, that was a very visual example of how public pressure can work in this case, even though the kayaktivists weren't necessarily successful. But ultimately, how much did public pressure have to do with President Obama's decision to protect these areas from drilling?
You know, I think the election almost perhaps more had more impact on the ultimate decision by increasing pressure on the administration to try to Trump-proof a lot of his climate and environmental legacy. I think, you know, had Trump not won the election, perhaps the administration would not feel as much pressure to have done this in the waning weeks of the president's time in the White House. That said, the whole reason this was on the president's radar, the whole reason that Obama has looked with more scrutiny on Arctic drilling is, I think, because of the public outcry, because of the very visual demonstration of opposition that we saw in Seattle and, you know, frankly, against Shell's plans. So, that's the reason it was on the administration's radar. That kind of pressure formed the backdrop and really the opening for environmentalists to get into the White House and kind of pitch this really novel legal strategy.
Well, you just said that you think this presidential election had a lot to do with President Obama's decision to move to protect these areas indefinitely. Do you think the incoming Trump administration will let that protection stand?
Not at all. I think they're going to, they haven't said so directly, but I fully expect, and I'm not alone in this, I fully expect that very swiftly, this will be one of the executive orders that Trump rescinds, perhaps on day one. That said, it could be years before we really know what the outcome is. It's going to be tested in court. And frankly, there's not a lot of legal precedent for judges to go on. This rule has never really been scrutinized in court. This particular provision, rather, has never been scrutinized in court. And legal challenges may not even be viewed as ripe for federal court's intervention until a Trump administration moves to put Arctic leases up for grabs again.
That's Jennifer DeLoey, energy reporter with Bloomberg News. And later this hour, we'll talk with Vaughn Palmer about Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau's move to protect the Canadian Arctic from drilling. Earlier this year, The Stranger's Sydney Brownstone broke a story about several Seattle women who claimed they were duped into having sex with a man named Matt Hickey. Brownstone uncovered that Hickey was using Facebook to pose as a porn recruiter, reach out to young women, and tell them they had the right look to make money in the business. Here's Brownstone describing the scam.
It's my job to get women into the porn industry safely because I've seen them get into some sketchy situations that didn't turn out to be real. I exist because I know there are scammers out there. And I will put you in touch with my best photographer, Maddie. He's my ex-boyfriend. He's great. You just need to go over to his apartment for an audition. And he allegedly told them that part of the audition was having unfilmed sex with him in order to prove that they could do it.
The women who thought they were auditioning never heard from any porn companies, and many of them felt violated after their audition. Late yesterday, the state attorney general filed a lawsuit against Matt Hickey. Andrea Allegret is handling the case for the attorney general's office.
So we're filing a Consumer Protection Act lawsuit against him. It's under our state statute. So it's a civil, there are civil statute claims against him.
And this is the first time the state attorney general is using these laws, the Consumer Protection Act, the Commercial Electronic Mail Act, in this way. My understanding of those laws is they're in place to protect people from things like mail fraud, that kind of thing. So why use them to prosecute someone who allegedly assaulted women?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what really struck me with this case when I first learned about it is how much of the scam was really a business scam. So much of what I took from reading the Stranger's piece originally is that this person, Deja, was essentially claiming to run a business that advertised certain services to people in Washington. And so those types of cases are very common for us to bring when we find out that either services aren't being provided or a business is using kind of unfair or deceptive means to deceive Washington consumers.
And you mentioned Deja. That was one of the aliases that Matt Hickey allegedly used online. She was a woman. She was supposed to be a recruiter for porn to bring women in to quote unquote audition, which meant having sex with Matt Hickey, allegedly. But there's also a criminal lawsuit against Matt Hickey. So why pursue a civil suit against him as well?
So the criminal suit is quite different from our case. The facts there are second-degree date rape charges, and they don't actually include all the women who were kind of fell victim to his adult entertainment scam.
And you said that what struck you about this case was that he was allegedly duping consumers. This was a business scam. How do you think he was able to get away with that for as long as he did? Allegedly, he did this for years.
Yeah, and I think one thing we see here is that when some of the most effective scams are those where people don't actually know they're being scammed. And he just took so many deliberate steps to make himself appear as if he has this real legitimate business that can provide career opportunities for women. And our investigation just continued to uncover more and more steps that he took to mislead people and make them believe that this is a real company and that these are genuine opportunities.
What was it like investigating this case in order to gather enough evidence to present charges in the first place? As you said, this is the first time that you know of that the state attorney general is using these laws in this way. So what was it like investigating this case and trying to gather evidence?
Well, we generally don't really talk about cases while we're investigating them, but as you can see in the complaint, we actually were able to develop and find a lot of evidence of how far and intentional all his deceptive conduct was. You know, it was very motivating, essentially. As part of our investigation, we uncovered that there was there's at least one other fake online profile that Matt Hickey created to mislead women towards his business scheme. And this was the profile of a young woman on Facebook. And he used this account to contact women that were solicited by the Deja Swali profile and encourage them to audition with Matt Hickey and to work with Deja Swali, essentially saying, I'm just like you. I was contacted by Deja Swali, and now I have a career and I'm making money, so you can too. And we were able to uncover that the email address he used to create this account was fakegirl@matthickey.com.
What did you think when that was uncovered?
It just seemed that there was a lot of information out there to get, that his conduct is very intentional, that he did these things to mislead women for his own personal gain.
Is this the first time that you've seen a case like this where someone took steps over years to continue to fool people into business opportunities, what they thought would be business opportunities?
This is the first case that I've really seen where we've taken the Consumer Protection Act to go after someone who's doing this type of conduct that's been going on for so long. And the truth is that this information sometimes doesn't really come to light. People don't like to talk about it. But fortunately, we were able to learn of this scam and actually do something about it.
Well, beyond this one case of Matt Hickey and what he allegedly did, what do you want this case to accomplish? What's the message you're hoping to send?
I'm hoping that people will realize that our office really is here for you. We're here for all people of Washington to protect them under unfair and deceptive conduct, that we don't judge people. We don't judge you if you're a sex worker. We don't judge or ask questions whether or not you're documented here. We really want to protect consumers and take that very seriously, and that we are here to hold people that are using deceptive and unfair conduct in their business scheme. We try to hold them accountable no matter really what the type of harm is.
Andrea Allegret is an assistant Washington State Attorney General. She's one of the lawyers who filed a lawsuit against photographer Matt Hickey. And we're tweeting out a link to Stranger reporter Sydney Brownstone's coverage of this story now. This is The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel. You're with The Record on KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke. Back in 2007, at a flea market in Springfield, Tennessee, a woman found a yellow cloth sack. On the sack, hand-stitched in red and green needlepoint, was the story of a woman named Rose and her daughter Ashley. They were both slaves, and when Ashley was 9, she was separated from her mom Rose and sold in South Carolina. The sack was a gift from Rose to Ashley, and the stitching included a signature of Ruth Middleton, the granddaughter of Ashley, and the year 1921. That stitching was all anyone knew about Rose and Ashley and Ruth Middleton. But then Central Washington University's Mark Auslander began investigating.
The first thing I thought about was, well, Rose is a very common name, and one of the most common names of all enslaved women in the 1800s. Ashley's one of the very rarest. So that seemed a little bit interesting. Also was interesting, if you look at the wording of the sack, which says that Ashley was sold away from her mother as a 9-year-old girl in South Carolina, that needlework suggests that probably Ruth Middleton, when she was embroidering this sack, did not, in fact, live in South Carolina. Because if you lived in South Carolina, you'd say, well, this happened over in Fairfield County, or this happened in Edgefield, or this happened in Columbia. You wouldn't say in South Carolina.
So that, like, geographic specificity was missing?
So, which suggests that this was probably what we call a great migration story. Starting, of course, around the time of World War I, so many African Americans left the South, came north, Chicago, Detroit, or up the eastern seaboard, and eventually, of course, came out here to Puget Sound. And at that point, certain kinds of stories would be forgotten, but others would be passed on. This seemed like a great migration story. So that was a hint, too. So I began to look both for Ruth Middletons, who plausibly could have been in the North, as well as looking at old slavery records of Rose and Ashley.
And I want to just be clear for listeners who don't know, Rose and Ashley are the two women whose names are on the sack. They were both slaves. Mm-hmm. Ruth Middleton was their ancestor. She was not a slave. She was the one who embroidered their names on this sack. So what did you learn in trying to combine Ashley's name, an uncommon slave name, with Rose, a common slave name, and looking for where they were in South Carolina? What did you find out?
The knowing that there was a 9-year-old who had been sold, as tragic as it is, that gives us a hint. It seemed most likely that that would have happened. I mean, of course, sometimes children were sold ordinarily, but usually they were sold with their mothers. But special sales like that usually happened at estate sales after the death of a major slave owner. And from the standpoint of us as historians, that's in a sense a good thing. It's a horrible thing that happened, but it means that there are probably estate records or a good chance, because so many aspects of the lives of enslaved people cannot be recovered. But if they show up in court-ordered records to do with estates, that would be a good thing. So I began to go through thousands and thousands of estate records. Some of those are online. A lot of them are only available in the South Carolina archives, or in some cases in courthouses through rural South Carolina. So I looked at a lot of slave records. And at first I thought I'd maybe find in the same inventory record a Rose and an Ashley in the same place. And I didn't do that. But then I thought, well, perhaps they were simply owned by the same person and were linked in that way, but they could have been in different estate bundles. And that's what I found in the actually in the Charleston inventory, which is a special document that was fortuitously copied before the Civil War, because the original records were destroyed in a fire during the Civil War. On one page, I find a Rose who was owned by a very prominent Charleston merchant, Robert Martin, one of the wealthiest men in Charleston, who left behind one of the most palatial mansions well known in the city. And 100 miles away, this is in a separate set of documents on different pages, were about the names of about 100 slaves whom he owned when he died in 1852. And one of those was the child Ashley. And seeing that they were owned, Rose and Ashley were owned, and then that the estate had to be divided up to raise a lot of money for Robert Martin's white heirs, that put us on the trail.
I know that this is your work. You look into the history of slavery in the United States, but there's also something very compelling and moving about the idea of combing through estate records to learn about what happened to people, to learn about what happened to a mother and her child. What was that? What was that like?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. Of course, there's a professional side. I teach. I direct a museum. I spend a lot of time studying objects. But this is different. It seemed like a profound personal and ethical responsibility. We teach our students so often. We study the history of the 4 million enslaved people who were human property in 1860 when Lincoln was elected at the beginning of the Civil War. But beyond all those numbers and beyond the staggering wealth that was associated with the slavery system is this profoundly personal story. And, you know, in the middle of this, I began to remember a rabbi who had said in reference to 9/11, you know, it wasn't that 3,000 people died on that day. A person died 3,000 times. And this object gave us the opportunity to honor those specific people, not just the numbers, not just the thousands, the millions, but to honor a very specific story of a mother and a child who were separated. And getting the details right just seemed so important. And it did start to obsess me, I think, over this last year. That's right.
I wonder how often you thought about Ruth Middleton when you were searching for Rose and Ashley and what happened to them. I mean, all Ruth knew about her ancestors were that one of them was sold as a child and separated from her mother, and mm-hmm. she was able to put that on this sack. How often did you think of her and what she didn't know about her family as you searched
for them? I was so fascinated that she had done that. We have so many amazing oral stories that have come down in African-American history, of course, stories of slavery that were transmitted. But it's very rare that they're written down, and I don't know of any case in which they were written down in needlework in this particular way. And so I was always wondering, well, why would she do that? Why would this story that had come down for perhaps 80 or 90 years orally, why did she feel the need to write it down? But once we were able to figure out who Ruth Middleton was, when I found her marriage certificate in the Philadelphia City Hall, and I realized that she'd probably been pregnant when she was getting married and that her husband had soon after abandoned her. So that means that in 1921, she was a single mother raising a two-year-old girl up in Philadelphia, probably very difficult to reduce circumstances. And now we can at least imagine a scenario. She was telling the story to her little girl, but it wasn't the way that maybe her mother had told her the story back in South Carolina. Now they were in a different place. And something about coming north, being in this new, exciting, but challenging world meant that it wasn't just enough to tell the story surrounded by many relatives, but just mother and daughter. And at that point, she decided to translate, it would seem, the oral story into something written. And she wrote it very beautifully with a great literary skill, I must say. Beautiful needlework, beautiful handwriting, but also just a wonderful way in 54 words of conveying this story. And I could even read those words if you would like that.
I was just going to ask. I had an inkling that you might have them memorized because there's only 54, but if you have them, I'd love to hear it.
My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at age 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her, "It be filled with my love, always." She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother, Ruth Middleton, 1921. So that's all we have of this amazing story, are those 54 words. But so much is packed into them. And the more you read it and think about those words, and she's done it in different colors, very carefully designed. And the largest line in red is, "It be filled with my love always." And the word love comes in the exact center of the needlework, so that it just in large letters fills all this. And for many African-American older women in South Carolina, the moment they see this, they begin to cry. And they say, well, this reminds us of the words of Jesus in the Bible, always in red. And that, they feel, is what sort of woke up the bag. For many of them feel the bag is a sacred object, what they would call kanjo or mojo or obia, a sacred African-influenced tradition of a bag that carries medicine, and that it has to be woken up. And that line, "It be filled with my love always," it just reduces everyone to tears. It's all she could give were those objects and her love, but that the bag became a sort of protective talisman is how they think about it.
You've obviously seen the bag as well, yes?
I have. It's beautifully installed at the new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. And I was there for the scholars opening, and it was very exciting. The curators have really done an amazing job. It was beautifully installed at Middleton Place down in South Carolina, but now it's, of course, a national treasure, and it's really in the heart of the new Smithsonian Slavery and Freedom Concourse, which is the first thing you do see when you go into the museum, just opposite the words of Thomas Jefferson and all the paradoxes of liberty. It's next to a big installation of an actual slave auction block, with a lot of information about the millions and millions of dollars that were bound up in enslaved people. And then just next to it is this very quiet installation of the bag that reminds us of the personal, the human aspects of slavery. It wasn't just a financial and a political system. It meant these sort of human horrors. But it does more than that. I think when you see it, and the way that it's been displayed is you see the whole seed sack, and then at the bottom you see that it's embroidered. And it reminds you of something important, which is that we often think of slavery in terms of suffering, but we have to remember the narratives of resilience, of courage, and of family continuity. You can't imagine a family being more terribly torn apart than by a slave auction of a 9-year-old little girl. But this family story continued. And I think that's the amazing thing. When you see it in the museum or when you're able to get close to it and you think, well, Ashley and Rose, they were separated by the slave sale. There's Ruth Middleton, one of their descendants, who's separated by a great deal of geography. But they're all together on this sack. And I think that's what makes it, to my mind, a national treasure, because it reminds us that of all the terrible things that we can do to one another in the human family, a family does endure. And that's a very important lesson, especially at a very uncertain historical moment like we find ourselves now, where nobody knows really what's coming, especially in terms of issues of diversity and equal justice under law and so forth, to be reminded of the extraordinary strength and courage of this line of women of color, who pass on this gift of storytelling. And then Ruth Middleton, as probably a 19-year-old single mother, is able to translate it into this beautiful story, not made for public consumption. Then it's lost for all these years. And then it turns up unexpectedly in 2007. It turns up in a flea market. And that's how it was finally given to Middleton Place and then came to the Smithsonian. So it's a sort of miraculous story, many wild coincidences. But it does remind us of this extraordinary continuity of the family. It's a story of lineage. And that's an important story for us all to remember right now.
You described what it was like watching women of color look at that embroidery and see the word love centered in the embroidery. What was it like for you to realize that that was the word that your eye was drawn to by design? That's how Ruth Middleton designed
it. Right, yes. I mean, it does sweep you away. You sort of move from being the, quote, rational or objective scholar at the moment like that when you really think of that terrible separation. I mean, everybody brings to a museum, to an object, their own stories. I immediately began to think of the story of my own great-grandparents who were lost in the Holocaust and how I've tried, you know, over the years with other members of my family to trace exactly what happened to them in the killing fields of what's now the Ukraine, where they were taken by the Romanian fascists in collaboration with the Nazis. And I think that that's part of what drives a lot of us who work on these stories of terrible of slavery and suffering, is a desire to do right by those who were lost. So whether or not it's the Holocaust or stories of contemporary genocide or of long ago suffering, it's important for us all to have these difficult conversations, because when you look into that word and see love and think of the loss, but also of that triumph of a literary and artistic sense that's in a concentrated way capturing this story, it holds up a mirror to all of us. And that's a very important thing.
Mark Auslander is an associate professor of anthropology at Central Washington University and director of the university's Museum of Culture and Environment. The cloth sack is now on display at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and we're tweeting out a photo of the sack now. That's at KUOW. At Lyell Falls, Washington's Klickitat River rushes toward the Columbia River Gorge. It's one of a few places where members of the Yakima tribe still fish from scaffolds using dip nets. Fishermen say it's the only place that comes close to what used to exist on the Columbia River. EarthFix reporter Cassandra Pafita has this story about the generations of tribal fishermen who have learned to fish there.
You can hear the roar of Lyell Falls long before you reach the river. In the parking lot above, James Kayona Jr. with the Yakima tribe picks up his dip net. The pole attached to the net is more than three times his height.
My father made this net.
He checks for holes in the hand-tied mesh inside the big hoop at the end of the pole.
These are all like a half-inch knot.
He sets the pole down on a steep rock ledge. Then he slings the rope around his waist, climbs down the near vertical rock to a wooden platform, and slides the 30-foot pole down from the ledge. As he dips his net into the churning water below, he's following a long-standing tribal tradition. He grew up watching his elders fish here.
As a young kid, I'd run up and down this whole river, just all over the place with my brothers and sisters, you know, and my cousins. All the elders would tell us, oh, you be careful around the river, you know, because it is a very violent river.
When he was old enough, his father, James Kayona Sr., taught him.
I wanted to teach him earlier, but, you know, you gotta want to fish. When he decided that he wanted to fish, and that's when I taught him.
Super early in the morning, I came up here with my father and he put me on this scaffold right up here. I was just learning the motions, you know, not thinking I was going to catch anything.
Now he's part of a larger family of tribal fishermen.
It's like a community up here, you know, all these people up here, they're all my relatives, they're all my family.
Tribal members have fished along these rock walls for centuries, The younger generations learn from their elders how to use the dip net to feel for the fish below.
Rock, piece of wood, fish, you know the difference. You can feel it.
And when a salmon hits the net,
the fight's on. Oh man, so exhilarating, you know, get your heart pumping. Every fish is different. They got a different fight in them. It requires a lot of upper body strength because you got to pull the pole up.
For James Kiona Sr., this fishery has taken the place of Celilo Falls on the Columbia River, where he grew up.
I used to run around there when I was a kid. And I used to go down there, pack fish for the fishermen. They'd give me a nickel for a fish.
When the Dalles Dam was built, the falls were flooded and the fishery at Celilo was lost.
You know, we've seen the falls go under before. You know, when the high water came, just had to sit and wait until the falls came back. This time it never came back.
Keeping the tribal tradition at Lyle Falls hasn't been easy, according to Johnny Jackson. He's a chief with the Cascade Tribe within the Yakima Nation.
I'm 85 years old. I might not be here that much longer, but this is where I learned to fish.
When he was young, Jackson would fish here at night, hiding in the rocks from the state game wardens who arrested many of his family members.
I remember when the state used to try to push the Indians off this fishery here, but our people had to fight back and still fish. Because it's one thing that the states and the white people never realized, that the salmon, which we know as Wakanish, was our main food and way of life, and we depended strongly on it.
James Kiona Sr. says the tribes make sure to leave some fish in the river to protect future runs.
We don't fish to the last fish. We fish to catch what we need and to support our families. And we have closures to let the fish go by, so we know that there will be more fish coming back in the years to come for our children and our grandchildren.
He hopes the tribes can keep the fishery going strong by continuing to pass their knowledge down from generation to generation. I'm Cassandra Profita reporting.
This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Jeannie Yandel. People who are severely mentally ill and in crisis often can't afford expensive private care, so many of them can end up in county jails, and jail staff aren't prepared to care for them. Seattle PI reporter Levi Pulkkinen looked into some of those cases and found stories of three young men in Washington state who were put in county jails and ended up dying. One of them was Jimmy Johnson. He was 27 years old and experiencing a crisis with his schizophrenia. He'd also been moved around emergency rooms and jails for months before he entered the Mason County Jail for one last time in April of 2013.
Jimmy's grandma had been working incredibly hard to get him into some kind of treatment program that would actually address his schizophrenia. He'd been bouncing in and out of hospital emergency rooms and jail. I mean, that had been his pattern. He would have better stretches and then just come apart and wind up in the emergency room and then be sent back home in, you know, a number of hours or a day. And then he'd come apart again. It was just this this kind of yo-yo that they were stuck on. As far as I can tell, he never got care in the community that was meaningful.
What happened the last time he ended up in the county jail?
So his last arrest in Mason County, his jail stay didn't go well at all. That jail is not well equipped to serve people who are in a mental health crisis. And he was ultimately able to kill himself. He had been placed in a jail cell that was not at all suicide-proofed. He had a bed sheet. He used it to hang himself. It's basically the way that prisoners kill themselves. It's an unusual outcome, and it's entirely preventable.
Well, you said it's an unusual outcome, but in your reporting, you gave two other examples of inmates who died. They were in solitary. They were in, as you called it, mental health crisis. Why does that keep happening?
Well, our county jails aren't regulated in this state. There's no meaningful state oversight of how they operate. They often are poorly funded. most of them weren't built to deal with people having severe mental health issues, and they're poorly equipped to do so.
And you actually quote a former jail worker who indicated that jail management maybe might have been part of the problem. This former jail worker said, "We don't have the tools to deal with people like this."
Yeah, and that's not specific to Mason County. That people who run jails are trained to run jails. They're not trained to run these kind of de facto mental health facilities. They're not trained to do the work they're being asked to do. In Mason County, I mean, there was a notable exchange that I came across in my reporting where the gentleman who is now the elected sheriff there had been asking the county council for money to do what's called crisis intervention training for jail staff. Basically, you train them, you give them the skills to respond quickly when you see somebody who's a threat to themselves. They couldn't get the money together to do even that, let alone create real systems within that jail to better serve people who are in crisis.
But this isn't just a problem in Mason County. It's not just a problem in Washington State. This is an issue in jails across the country. There are people in mental health crisis who end up going in. They don't get treated as people with mental illness. They get treated as inmates who are behavioral problems. And in some cases, they end up doing exactly what Jimmy Johnson did. So how did it get to this point where jails became, I think, as you called them, de facto mental institutions?
Well, I mean, there's a pretty straight line from the deinstitutionalization initiatives in the 70s and 80s to where we are today, where basically people who have severe mental health issues, that, you know, especially people who have psychotic or extremely paranoid mental experiences, they basically end up in the emergency room, in jail, or on the street. And that's because we don't really have anywhere else to put them. The community supports that were supposed to come online as we were closing these mental hospitals never arrived.
Where did that movement come from? I'm trying to remember how that happened. How did that happen?
The idea was that these are places, the mental health hospitals in the country, I mean, many of them were full of abuse, and there were people being kept there that didn't need to be, that could function in the community. And it was seen as a moral wrong to keep folks locked up that way. There's a lot of backpatting that we do about not keeping people in these kind of one flew over the cuckoo's nest style mental institutions. And there's probably good reason to celebrate that people aren't being locked up for being mentally ill in those institutions. But the reality is we're doing it with the county jails instead. And that's not a reasonable way to approach this problem.
You did report on a jail in Des Moines, Washington, that's trying something different when they do have inmates who are in mental health crisis. It's called the South Correctional Entity, or SCORE. What's happening in that jail? What are they doing?
About a year or so ago, the folks at SCORE kind of had an awakening where they changed the ethos of their jail. They recognized that they are a mental health care provider, that's part of what they do, and it's not what they should be doing. They don't deny that jail is not the place where ideally this would be happening, but the reality is it is. So in changing that ethos, what they did is they brought in some folks that are trained to help people. They brought in, I think they're going to staff up to 4 mental health counselors and a nurse who can manage prescriptions. And what they've seen is that enables them not to place folks into solitary confinement. And that's a huge benefit, because what we know is that solitary is a bad place to be generally, and it's a very bad place to be if you're experiencing a mental health crisis.
Do you think that those kinds of reforms are scalable, though? It's remarkable that there is a jail that has sort of dealt with the reality of the situation, which is they are dealing with people in mental health crisis and those people need treatment. But is that something that other jails could adopt?
Well, there are aspects of it that probably aren't. It's a larger jail. They deal with a specific population. It's a misdemeanor jail. So it's folks that aren't on track to spend long prison sentences necessarily. But if SCORE is seen as the gold standard, there are plenty of steps between where we are now and there that we could take. I mean, proper screening of people coming into a jail is not an impossible thing to do. Making sure that our jail staff across the state is trained so that they can identify people who are suicide risks is not impossible to do. Making sure that we're not putting people who are suicidal into cells where they have the tools they need to kill themselves is something we can do. There's a basic ethical commitment you make when you're taking people into custody. When you're taking someone's freedom from them, what you're saying is, I will take care of you because I'm putting you in a position where you cannot take care of yourself. Prisoners can't go down to Safeway if they're hungry. They can't get a job. They can't provide for themselves. They can't seek out their own medical care. If we are going to take the freedom from these folks, then we have to provide that care. That's the basic commitment you make as, you know, as a jailer or as a society that puts people in confinement. And we're not doing that right now.
Levi Pulkkinen is a reporter for the Seattle PI. We're tweeting out a link to his story now. Well, as we heard about earlier this hour, President Obama has announced that future oil and gas leasing is indefinitely off limits in vast areas of U.S. waters, including parts of the Arctic. And Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau joined him in a similar move. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer is here to tell us more about that. Hi, Vaughn.
Hi, Jeannie.
So what is Prime Minister Trudeau doing to restrict drilling right now?
Quite similar to what President Obama has done. There's a couple of things different, but the first thing, of course, is that the two governments have joined together to make this announcement, I think sending the same signal about protecting the Arctic. The agreement they've struck, or the joint announcement, is threefold. First of all, the same kind of ban, on indefinite ban on oil drilling leases through the Canadian Arctic. Second of all, an agreement by Canada and the United States to begin working for the future on identifying the safest shipping routes through that area as the ice goes and as the Arctic opens up to shipping. And third of all, an agreement to look at protecting the fishery up there and opening up the waters for fishing by the indigenous people. Again, as the ice goes and the waters open up, there is expected to be a fishery up there. So Canada and the United States are going to work together on identifying the best places.
So overall, what's the response been to this joint announcement in Canada?
Well, there's been a couple of things here. I guess the first thing that's interesting is there is one difference. The Canadian ban, whereas the American ban is permanent, depending, of course, on legal challenges.
Right. We're putting scare quotes around the word permanent if you're not in the room with us.
That's right. There will be an argument over that, I suspect, the courts will deal with. Here, the Canadian government has simply announced that this indefinite ban will be reviewed every 5 years. So a long-standing tradition in Canadian law that one government cannot bind future governments. So I think that sort of recognizes the idea of a review is that if there's a change of government or a change of circumstances, the ban would be subject to a review 5 years from now.
So what does this mean for companies, even though in 5 years things could change, what does this mean for companies who currently already have leases to drill in the Arctic?
It doesn't really mean an awful lot. There are a bunch of leases already. No one is exercising those leases at the moment because oil prices are too low. So frankly, the companies, some companies are looking for extensions, but nobody is exercising their leases at the moment. I think if prices recover, if other areas in the world where oil and gas has been developed, if those start to play out, then I think there'd be renewed interest. But at the moment, it's a kind of a hypothetical thing. Nobody is exercising those leases anyway, and existing leases are not affected. This would apply to new licenses, It also might affect licenses, their time dated, that are running out. The government may simply not renew those, which would mean they would expire.
Vaughn, you said that there's a provision in Canadian law where every 5 years provisions and laws are reviewed so that future governments don't have to follow what previous governments did. But even before that 5-year time period, would it be hard to reverse the ban that Prime Minister Trudeau just announced?
I think as long as he's in power, no one's going to reverse it. You asked me about reaction, and there was a reaction yesterday by the government of Canada's Northwest Territories, which covers most of the Canadian Arctic. The head of that government said he was very disappointed that the national government had made this decision without consulting the local people. So the Canadian courts have held that where resource development is at stake, either thumbs up or thumbs down, the Indigenous people of the country have a right to be consulted and their interests accommodated. So it is possible there could be a court challenge. But again, I think the situation for development up there of oil and gas is so hypothetical that that probably wouldn't come to fruition for a while anyway. Trudeau himself will be facing re-election in, 2019? His current, if there were a change of government, obviously the next government, as I say, would have the option of suspending this or reversing it or expanding it for that matter, because there's, a general recognition in Canadian law that a government today can't bind a future one, although if a decision is taken like creating a national park or banning development in a certain area, it does take a certain amount of political will to reverse that. Very rarely are those kind of decisions reversed, even though governments have the option of doing so.
Well, we know that these bans represent a win for environmentalists who are concerned about climate change and how that's affecting the Arctic, but environmentalists are already pretty unhappy with Prime Minister Trudeau's approval of the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, which we've talked about before with you. The expansion triples the amount of oil sent from the Alberta oil sands to the Vancouver area. It means more oil tankers going through the Strait of Juan de Fuca. So what's the latest on that pipeline approval?
Trudeau was in British Columbia yesterday doing news media. He spoke to my newspaper, the Vancouver Sun. He did CBC, did a bunch of other radio, and all on the same message, that this is of a piece. For Canada's climate action plan to work, the Canadian economy must be made to work as well. For Canada's limit on emissions from the Alberta oil sands to work, Canada must be getting its oil to world markets and get a better price. So it's all of a piece, says Trudeau. And you're right, he's increasingly fitting all this together. He's saying, look, I'm doing this for the environment, I'm doing this for the economy, and for all of this to work, it has to work together. It is not an easy political sell, Jeannie. However, the most recent opinion poll out this week shows that British Columbians are evenly divided on the pipeline expansion, about 45% in favor, about 45% opposed, so split right down the middle. Considering the amount of backlash from environmental groups in BC over that decision, it's remarkable that public opinion is so easily divided. It suggests that, to me anyway, that Trudeau has made some progress persuading Canadians that this is needed for the economy, even if it is opposed by some environmentalists.
Well, we'll certainly keep talking with you about that pipeline. It'll affect us all over the Pacific Northwest. Vaughn Palmer, thank you so much for joining us, as you do every week.
Bye-bye, Jeannie.
Vaughn Palmer is a Vancouver Sun columnist. We talk to him every Wednesday about the connection between the Pacific Northwest and Canada. Thanks for joining us on The Record. I'm Jeannie Yandel in for Bill Radke, and BBC News is next.